So, Bill, the topic of today's show is science in Washington. What do you think of that?
There is science in
That's
Washington.
That's what I said, too. Yeah. And actually, we're going to be talking with Rob Butera right here from Georgia Tech, who spent, what was it, last year, Rob, as a Jefferson Fellow?
August 2008 through August 2009.
Okay, and what exactly did you do as a Jefferson Fellow?
That would take an hour to explain.
He set the government straight, man.
Okay, there it is.
He's straightening him out.
Rob Butera setting the government straight.
I wish.
That's what we're going to be talking about tonight.
And playing Rednecks versus Aliens on his iPod.
Which apparently is a fascinating app that many government officials like to play.
Yes,
that's what we've learned, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll explore that and many other issues about science in Washington. Next up on Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
If you're looking for the best electronic grooves in Atlanta, look no further. Coffee and Sushi plays all kinds of funky, jazzy, and soulful electronic music, with lounge and chill out combined with the best elements of trip-hop, bossa nova, and house music. Coffee and Sushi is mixed live every Thursday night from midnight to 1, right here on WRAK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
I just got back.
Check out the last show right now in the archive at WRAK.org or listen live by radio or online stream. Once again, that's Coffee and Sushi, Thursday nights from midnight to 1.
Bizarre, inviting you to tune into my country music classics here on WREK at 91.1 Friday evenings at 5 o'clock. We come alive at 5 with great old-time music. String bands, bluegrass, old country blues, a little of everything, jug bands, anything that you can imagine, you'll hear on the country music classics. All happy music. A little jug band. Don't forget, this is Friday at 5. We come alive right here with the Country Music Classics on WREK-FM 91.1. Make it a habit. Tune in. Love to have you. That's Fridays at 5 right here on WREK 91.1.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis, and as always, I'm joined by my ever-effervescent co-host, a man who wasn't quite the same after the selective resection of his prefrontal lobe, Bill Hunt.
Huh?
You were talking about lobotomies a couple weeks ago, right?
Nobel Prize winning stuff there, lobotomy.
So there it is. So you are at least loosely connected to the Nobel Prize.
Right. Because I've had one.
Because you've had one.
Yeah.
Or because you need one. I'm not really
sure which one. Needing one is the first step towards getting one.
All right. So the title of today's show is Science in Washington. And it's sort of a follow-up, sort of consisting or being consistent with the theme now that we're headed into the midterm elections. Two weeks ago, we had Richard Bark talking about science policy and things like that. And now we've got a sort of a hands-on example. Our guest today is Rob Butera, and he received his bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from Georgia Tech in 1991, although he seldom admits that. He did master's and PhD from Rice University in Houston, Texas. And following graduate school, he did postdoctoral research at the National Institutes of Health. While at the NIH, he worked jointly in the mathematical research branch and the laboratory for neural control. Nerd alert? Can I say nerd alert for that one?
You could say nerd.
Right. And,
no, only if it was for nurdle control.
So now he is on the electrical and computer engineering faculty and does work in sort of bioengineering and neuro stuff. That's the technical term for it. Because I don't have time to read this prestigious bio of his. And he's here today to talk to us about his experience as a Jefferson Fellow. So before we get into science and the news, what exactly is a Jefferson Fellow? You said it would take an hour, but, you know, give me the two-minute version of it.
Okay, I can give you the one-minute history and the one-minute process.
There you go.
Man, okay. Is he organized.
He is.
This program was created...
I'm timing him.
I think in 2003 when Colin Powell was Secretary of State to recognize that there wasn't much of a place for scientific expertise in the State Department. And you may not know it, but a lot of things the State Department does, which is... anything involving foreign policy, has a science component to it. And so this program was created, and the way it works is they team up with the National Academies of Science, and they put out a call for nominations, and any university can nominate someone. And the criteria are you're a mid-career senior professor, engineering or science, 10-plus years experience and tenured, and that's about it. And so... I saw it. I'd been wanting to do something policy-related ever since I was in graduate school, and I was always too busy doing that next thing, like getting the postdoc, getting the faculty job, getting tenure, and, you know, tenure was 5 or 6 or 7 years ago now.
And now so trying now to, keep your, to do it. Keep your wife from kicking you out of the house for playing games on your iPhone.
Yes.
Right. So can I say yay, Colin Powell? Yay, Colin Powell.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we're so critical of people. No, and whether you agree or we are, you are, you especially, you're bitter and angry.
We love all people, even Dick Cheney.
You just like to make fun of him.
I just think he'd make a great compost. That's all.
Okay. Don't beat around the bush. Say what you mean, Bill. So in any case, whether you agree or disagree with any of, you know, Colin Powell's views on that, that was good. So
it was good.
A general did something really good.
Yep.
Wow. So
I actually had a lot of respect for him. I mean, the other thing that was interesting in that too was there was an interview process. So you submitted the application,
right?
And what was the main thing that they were looking for in these Jefferson Fellows?
Oh, it was unlike any interview I had ever gone on. I've been part of the selection process now. So now they get about 60 to 80 applications for 8 or so slots, and so they go through a paper process of narrowing the pool down, and they're looking for faculty that not only have scientific or technical expertise, but kind of have people and political skills through, you know, being involved in federal advisory committees, grant review panels, professional society involvement, because Washington is ultimately political. Mm-hmm. And to survive in the State Department, you have to become part of the Borg and be able to function in a rigid hierarchy, which is unlike how we work in academia.
He said respectfully.
Well,
he also had to wear a suit. I saw him once in Washington. We got together for dinner.
I could never do this.
And he was wearing a suit every day.
Wow.
So anyway, the interview, to get us back on topic.
Yes, sorry.
You know, I walk in this room and there's a dozen people here. And it's some former ambassadors, State Department officials, some science policy people from the National Academies, as well as AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And they just start peppering you with sort of these hypothetical scenarios where there's no clear-cut answer.
So give us a for instance.
So you're in there. Okay, you're in Korea. Kim Jong-il suddenly spills his milkshake on you. What do you do? Or were they more scientific?
Kind of like that. Yeah, so the typical scenario is you're working in the embassy and the ambassador's been asked to give a speech on the U.S. government, defending the U.S. government's current stance on, let's say, global warming. And the speech is tomorrow. And You've got to write his talking points for him. How would you do that? And then what they do is they pull the rug out from under you and say, okay, now you're on the way to the speech and you're there just to kind of give him talking points. And all of a sudden he falls ill and you have to give the speech. And they try to construct the scenario in such a way that they might not even be points that you particularly like or find defensible, but you've got to find a way to deal with that compromise.
Right. And obviously faking an episode of narcolepsy is not one of the choices. Is it?
Not really, yeah.
That's what I'd go for.
So it can get kind of personally intense. I've heard rumors from past recipients that crying has happened in these interviews before. Didn't happen in my case. I heard they've gotten nicer.
Wow, that's cool. See, I mean, I would like that kind of interview, but I couldn't help but be making snide, snarky comments.
So
would not be a Jefferson Fellow, sir.
Apparently, swearing would be out of the game.
So, yeah, I actually think the interview is designed We have a very free culture in academia. We can say what we think.
Yeah.
We can tell our boss to go where they think the sun doesn't shine. If we, mm-hmm. it might not have good long-term consequences, but we're free to do it. I mean, academia is about open dialogue.
Yeah.
And in the State Department, it's all about what's the official policy, when do you disagree publicly, when do you disagree privately, and how do you plug into the hierarchy. And so they want people that can conform to the process and know when it's appropriate to speak up and when to keep their mouth shut.
Right, right. Okay, well.
That's my own take on it. It's not official policy.
That'd be so tough.
All right, well, we'll talk a little bit more about the nuances of that. Let's start the show, as we often do, with...
Science in the News.
And seeing as how we are running up to the midterm elections, it's only appropriate we look at what candidates are saying about science. So I'm going to actually make some reference to a blog posting today from Gina Maria Cheeseman, who also blogs on environmental issues, on the Care to Make a Difference blog. But if you want a more traditional flavor of this, it's not really that different from the October 3rd op-ed piece called Fear and Favor by Paul Krugman in the New York Times, where he talks about science rather than being guided by what we think is happening. And notice think is the operative word, right? Because, I mean, we don't really know what's happening with global science. We argue about lots of issues. It's a very complicated system, so that's perfectly fine. But Gina Marie Cheeseman points out that Nevada's Sharon Angle is the woman running against Senator Harry Reid. She's also one of the Republican candidates who deny climate change is occurring. Angle calls climate change a fraudulent science. A survey by the Wonk Room found that almost all the Republican Senate candidates are climate change deniers. Not one of them supports climate change. Angle is not alone. In the following comments from two Senate candidates indicate, so here's one from Mark Rubio of Florida. I don't think there's scientific evidence to justify it. The climate is always changing. And it's far more likely that it's just sunspot activity. That's from Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. But Cheeseman goes on to point out that there's a link between the Republican Senate candidates who deny the existence of climate change and oil money. Many of the Republican Senate candidates signed the Americans for Prosperity No Climate Tax Pledge. According to investigation by Desmog Blog, AFP is the third largest recipient of funding from the Koch family foundations. And we all know that the Koch brothers, I mean, I work in the chemical industry. Mm-hmm. We're afraid of the Koch brothers in the chemical industry, not even on the political end. And the point is, I don't think what we're trying to say is these people are idiots for saying that, okay, maybe climate change isn't as well understood as we thought and we should immediately park our cars by the side of the road and get out. But it's something is happening, and it bears further scrutiny and further investigation, and you have to take an unbiased approach to it.
Right.
And there's maybe bias.
Yeah, and I guess my opinion is that...
you have an opinion, Bill? I was not aware of this.
Yeah, you haven't been listening. Yeah, so, I mean, I actually think that, you know, you can certainly look at CO2 as a source of global warming, but I've got serious questions about it. There is solar activity at its peak. But to have an attack on the scientific community based on this is what I have problems with.
Yeah, to say that the answer is still out.
You know?
Fraudulent, yeah.
Yeah, say that the jury's still out, I'm okay with that. But fraudulent sounds like they're faking all the results. And these are the same people that think they saw Elvis last week down at the Piggly Wiggly getting some ding-dongs, you know.
I don't think wasn't he a Twinkie guy?
Ding Dongs came along in the early 70s, so
right.
I think he...
That is just my understanding. I'm not going to go on a limb.
The Ding Dong was invented before Elvis had that final episode on the porcelain throne.
So Rob, thoughts on
this? I had Ding Dongs in my lunchbox when I was 6 years old.
How does someone who, you know, has dealt with the gauntlet of government and government policy and approval, how would you approach a topic like this? I mean, we're just, hey, you know, we think they just ignore science and they cherry pick. In fact, we were talking about Chris Mooney's book, The Republican War on Science, just before the show. Yeah, he wrote a second book, and Cheryl Kirschenbaum was his co-author on that, where she pointed out that scientists get their butts kicked when they go in to talk to congressional members as compared to lobbyists, because lobbyists are smart enough to take a couple simple talking points from the science, cherry pick them, and hit them over the head with it.
And
whereas we actually try to tell them all the complex
stuff. Well, and the lobbyists go in with an envelope full of cash, so that's the other thing.
Oh, that might help.
Well, there's two components. There's the congressional component, which operates at light speed with tight deadlines, and then there's the federal component, which is more of a slow, deliberative process. Mm-hmm. And I mainly dealt with the federal side. So most of what we see in the press is the congressional side, where congresspeople have short fuses, short time scales. They eat an answer very fast. They often have a side they've already taken. And so I'm not sure to what extent you can ever change anyone's mind in that arena.
So that's at the congressional level.
Right. I went to a few talks when I was in D.C. There are very few scientists in Congress, and one of them is Rush Holt. I think he's a Democratic congressman from New Jersey. He's a physicist. No, sorry, Michigan. And he's a physicist by training.
And he's about to retire, and we have already contacted his office to try to get him on this show.
Right. And so Rush gave this story to this lunch that we were at. He was the guest speaker of how Congress views scientists. When the whole anthrax scare was going down, now here's a guy, he's a high-energy physicist, spent his whole career. Most of his congressional colleagues were like, "You're a scientist. Explain this to us."
You know, so he could make up whatever he wanted
like,
at
I'm
that
I'm not
point.
A microbiologist, but as far as Congress is concerned, a scientist is a scientist is a scientist. It's like saying, "You're a doctor. Explain this to us."
Right.
So they, I think science is so far removed from how most of them work that they view it all as like one big black box, pardon the pun.
It's a free plug for us.
Yeah.
So
that's and most scientists who go to Washington, they're often on these Senate committees. I know people have testified for congressional committees where they've got their 10 minutes of talking points. It all goes in the record. And then the Congress people generally just go on and vote how they wanted to vote. So I'm not sure how you can prepare there because it takes time to educate people to how science works.
But what you're saying is often Congress has already made up their mind.
Yes.
What helps them formulate their opinion? It sounds like it's not science because they haven't even seen the science yet. Is it big oil? Is it the economy? Is it other forces pushing on them? And it's okay to say, I don't know.
That's no, I want you to. So we went to one of the great things about my program is I actually went through a 2-week orientation, which is basically Washington, D.C. for scientists. Mm. It was put on by the American Association for Advancement of Science, and it's how they train their 100 or so AAAS policy fellows that come in every year. These are people with masters and PhDs and MDs.
Yeah, that's another and program.
It's another program.
One of my former students, Tony Dickerber,
right,
is one of those.
And they go to federal agencies. Many of them go work for Congress, congressional staff, and they have a 2-week training program about how D.C. works. And there was a great talk we had.
It takes 3 weeks to do how AC works, though. That's
alternating current?
No. Drum roll.
Well, I had to ask the question.
No.
Now you're giving out these complicated acronyms like AC.
Alternating current.
Because not everyone here is an electrical engineering faculty member.
Never mind.
So there's this physicist who gave this very quantitative analogy of what it takes to influence a congressperson. Mm-hmm. And to boil down his take-home message in 15 seconds, especially in the House, they are always running for re-election. They care more about what their constituents think than anything else, including even where their money comes from. And so letters and contact from constituents who live in their district who they think are going to affect their ability to get reelected will impact a congressperson more than anything. And so if you're going to educate them on science policy, that's the link to go through it.
So tell them something that will help make their constituents like them and vote for them.
Right.
I'd say maybe the real thing is to educate, get the their constituents in their district motivated and have an opinion. That's really the pressure point.
Wow. Well, let's try and pick that topic up after the break. And I just want to mention that we are talking to Rob Butera.
And the number.
Former Jefferson Fellow about science in Washington. Yep. And if you've got a question or comment about that, and surely there must be some, because I'm starting to see this may be a wacky conversation when we come back. Give us a call if you're listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1 at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back after this message on Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
Hi, professional skateboarder Tony Hawk here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have the energy to skate through anything.
Nice play on words, Doc.
That's how I roll, Bugs. So whether you like to work the half pipe,
now that's catching air,
kick the soccer ball around, or dance in your room,
just move it your way.
For an hour a day.
The way you like to move, as long as you're moving.
Carve out some time every day and get active. Because it's time to do a 180 on what you think exercise is.
Because it can be whatever you want it to be. So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
In the future, everyone's going to say, come down to the library, we'll have a wild time.
Spend a week in a dusty library, waiting for some words to jump in me.
Lost in the Stacks is the one and only Research Library rock and roll radio show. Every Friday at noon, Amit and Charlie from the Georgia Tech Library pick a theme and free associate an hour of music, interviews, and library talk.
You'll hear indie rock, pop rock, alt rock, new wave, and some random stuff we dig out of the vaults. In between music sets, we interview students, faculty, and librarians about Georgia Tech, libraries, and whatever else we can think of.
Lost in the Stacks is on every Friday at noon for your lunchtime library needs. Whatever you tune in for, we hope you dig it.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Robert Butera, former Jefferson Fellow, about how science works in Washington. And Trent, what was the question we had over the break from a listener?
I think it was, where is a good place to go for science fact that's a trusted source, I guess, for...
That's a good question.
...for the layperson or just for or even a politician or whatever.
Trusted also sort of might imply unbiased.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what would be...
So can I chime in?
Sure.
We want you
For high-profile topics... And I would never tell this to my students because it's not true for low-profile topics. Mm-hmm. But Wikipedia is a really good example for controversial topics because people have strong opinions and the back-and-forth editing distills it down to agreed-upon facts. So a great example is if you go to the Wikipedia website for abortion, you can imagine that's a topic that people have strong feelings about.
Monitored by both sides.
And yet you've got it distilled down to an undisputable set of facts that both sides can agree upon. And I'm sure, though I haven't been to it, if you go to the global warming page on Wikipedia, because it gets so much traffic and so many people try to edit it, you at least get down to a set of facts that people can agree upon, and it'll often highlight the issues that people don't agree upon.
Yeah, they do. They do point those out. And what
now, Wikipedia is bad for other stuff, but I think for really high-profile, high-traffic topics, Wikipedia is a good place.
So what's an example of a lower-profile topic? I mean, I think basically everything I do, you know, intermediate order in amorphous polymers, nobody cares, right?
Same here.
Another one might be...
And by that, he meant he doesn't care.
I got the insult, Bill. It's, nothing gets by you, Bill. Absolutely.
Just pointing out, because sometimes it gets by you.
All right, that is a good point. Yeah. But let's take, for example, I don't know... graphene?
Yeah. How to win a Nobel Prize. Blah. Keep removing.
We talked about this
Walt
a few weeks
DeHeer's,
ago.
Contributions on the Wikipedia page over and over.
And the graphene
again.
Description of the phenomenon is fairly reasonable, but who gets credit for it does get a little jimmied. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah. That's a good source. I think the problem with going to a book on something. You know, if the book is by the Society for, you know, Global Warming or whatever, you know, I think the old phrase, you got to consider the source. I mean, it's not necessarily going to give you an unbiased view of how critical this is or uncritical it is. So, I mean, that's getting an unbiased source is really a difficult thing to do. So,
all right. So before you basically described the nightmare that is trying to deal with Congress, that Congress occurs too quickly. They're always trying to get reelected. You might not have the greatest impact there. But how do you go about having impact more on sort of the federal department side? How does that work?
It's kind of a secret, but I'll explain the process.
We may have to kill all of us.
And I would mention, by the way, another key thing in Congress is every congressperson has staffers. And every staff person kind of has their pet topics. And one thing I learned in my year in D.C. on occasionally we dealt with stuff that was legislative related where they wanted our opinion on something in our office that I worked in. There is always some staffer in some congressman's office who is an expert on any given bill, at least aware of all the issues. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you want to go to those people because very often other congressional staff people defer to that person that in their close world of a few thousand staffers knows is the expert on that topic. So getting to that person helps.
And is that more effective then?
Definitely.
So what you're saying, talking to a congressperson basically like talking to a brick wall. They have different priorities. They're trying to get reelected. Things are moving very quickly. But the staffer can invest the time and energy into getting familiar with the topic.
If the staffer thinks it has impact or it's a cause that they're passionate about, one
okay.
or the other.
Okay. Okay, that's good to know. So what about other departments? State
okay.
department
so,
and other departments.
Federal. So I kind of had two experiences working in the State Department. So first, I worked in an office. It was a policy office in the Bureau that deals with arms control and nonproliferation.
Mm-hmm.
So stopping really bad technologies from spreading. And I dealt in the office that was called the Office of Chemical and Biological Weapons Threat Reduction,
mm-hmm.
which sounds nefarious, but it dealt with any foreign policy issue involving stopping the spread of chemical and biological technologies that could be used to cause really high impact mass attacks.
Well, that's important.
That's pretty important.
Yeah, somewhat.
Well, one piece of working in that office was, which gets to how policy is made in D.C., is D.C. is full of what are the names change with every administration, but they're interagency policy committees. So some organization at the White House decides an issue is important.
Mm-hmm.
And at the highest level, this would include things, whether it's the National Security Council, the Office of Science Technology Policy, heck, the Council of Economic Advisors. And those are like the real high-level political people that you might see the names of in the paper. But below all those committees, OSTP, National Security Council, you've got policy committees on different topics. Mm-hmm. And then those committees have subcommittees. Mm-hmm. And you could think about how this trickles down to eventually there's some subcommittee somewhere that's dealing with a particular issue. And I would go to some of those meetings, and we dealt with various topics dealing with federal policy on biological safety and security issues related to biotechnologies.
So what are you saying? You were talking to subcommittees of secondary committees?
Right.
We thought you had lunch with the president every day.
No.
I'm very disappointed.
You probably pick up basketball with
And so these committees, I admire the people who run them because these are staffers who work for the White House, and it's like herding cats. Because so you got this committee, and it's a lot like a faculty meeting. Because sitting in this room are representatives from various federal agencies that have their particular stake in the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So on the committees I was on, you'd have people from the State Department, from Commerce, from the Environmental Protection Agency, from Homeland Security, from Health and Human Services, from the Department of Defense. And they all bring different their agency's perspective to the table. It sounds boring, but I'm coming full circle to where the scientists can lobby is whatever issue they're studying. They tend to be kind of methodical about it and go about determining what the facts are, what the situation on the ground is, and then making some recommendations for change.
Mm-hmm.
So the best example I can give was something that took about half my time was one of the last executive orders that George Bush gave as president before he was going out of office.
So that's the other thing I was going to throw out, that he actually – your time, if you look at the time that he gave, was the end of Bush's administration and the beginning of the Obama administration.
Oh, yeah. I could give a whole talk about transitions and political appointees, mm-hmm. but we don't have time.
Okay. That'll be the topic of another show.
Right. But anyway, just point that out, that it was over two administrations. Go ahead.
Right. So this executive order, it was an executive order called something like Strengthening the Biosecurity of the United States. And he mandated that the White House had to convene a working group at a certain high level of authority. And that working group had to look at all the policies and regulations that affect biological research involving security-controlled substances, things like select agents, so things like toxins and nerve gas and things like that, mm-hmm. that or could be used for those kind of threats, look at the regulatory framework and ask, where is it working, where is it not working, and make recommendations. And this was an executive order. It said you have 180 days starting sometime in January, go. And my office director was the State Department representative to the steering committee of that working group. They had to have everyone on that working group had to be what's called senior executive service, which is the highest level you can be in the civil service below political appointees.
Okay.
But because my office director was so busy being sucked into other political crises, he eventually trusted me to the point that I kind of became his delegate to most of those working group meetings.
So were you senior executive service?
No. I was just a Georgia Tech professor on an interagency personnel
agreement.
Oh, right.
Do those guys get like a key to the executive washroom, secret handshake, something like that?
No, they kind of have a tenure-like job security, but it's just It's a certain class of employee that certain government jobs require.
Okay.
That's my knowledge of it.
What do you have to do to learn the secret handshake? Because I think Pete really wants to know that.
Indeed, I
do. I don't know. It was never shown to me.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
So the State Department did have a dining room that only senior executive service, political appointees, and GS-15s could dine in. I got to eat there once.
And what's a GS-15?
GS-15 is the highest rank of the civil service.
Oh, okay, so then spies like us is correct. Myself. So they were, what, GSG-20s or something? They just made that up? You never saw the movie with Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd?
No.
Okay.
No. But the military has a different designation, but it's also letters and numbers.
Okay. And this is government service level right. 15, right? Wow, so why did you even do this? You get no perks with this job. Did you do this out of the kindness of your heart to help steer your government in the right direction?
I wanted to see how it worked.
Okay. All right, that's good.
So anyway, this committee went in
I would point out that there's a big difference between reading a book about how it works and experiencing how it works. Is it Bobby? Is that your nickname on email that they've assigned you as Robbie?
I change it back to Rob.
Okay, yeah. Did you know that you get assigned a nickname on the email server at Tech?
Automatically.
Oh, okay. Yeah, anyway. But he wanted to experience it to learn about it. Sorry, I'm a little bit...
You're going off on a tangent again.
You're looking at me
all right,
like
back
I'm going
to
off
the,
on a tangent.
We've gone past the GS-15 dining room.
Yeah.
And you were talking about this particular, you know,
right.
bioterrorism
so,
proliferation.
But anyway, I saw this process at multiple levels. This committee is the best example. And we spent a good 4 months getting through what is the current status of the regulations, how does this affect or impede research? And so then we'd start going out and getting testimony from people. We'd actually get scientists from labs that are affected by select agent rules. So like if you're a biological researcher doing research on anthrax, of which, by the way, there are safe and unsafe strains, there are a lot of security laws that affect you and how you collaborate with other people, the controls you put on it. And so we want to know how well does that system work? How well does it not work? And so there are issues internal to the federal government, like there's different policies for how NIH does research versus mm-hmm. how DOD does research versus how someone who gets money from NIH at, say, at Emory University does research.
So National Institutes of Health, Department of Defense. You guys are big on acronyms in the government.
Government's full of acronyms.
So is engineering, though.
Yeah, that's true.
And so we spent a good amount of time laying down really documenting what are all the rules here, where did they come from, and then where did they get in the way and where do they work well. And now the scientist expertise comes in two ways. First of all, in determining where do they get in the way, our committee would seek out people both inside and outside the government to actually come talk to us and explain things to us. We also did lab tours because mm-hmm. A lot of this involved not just how you handle substances, but how do you do background checks on people? What controls do you have on these so-called level 3 and level 4 biosafety labs?
Mm-hmm.
And so we actually visited universities in the D.C. area. We visited military and NIH facilities. We visited commercial companies that do contract vaccine research. And they were all very open and gave us lab tours, showed us the various controls they have in place, were very candid with us on what they did and did not like.
So this is that level of candor that you're saying you were not always afforded as a Jefferson Fellow, but the kind you really appreciate
at
this
level. In this environment, we were afforded it, right?
Oh, okay. So they could say, look, this particular rule stinks, and here's why.
Right.
Okay.
Well, let me ask this. So at this interagency group that you're talking about, were you the only Jefferson Fellow? Were there five Jefferson Fellows?
Oh, no, I was the only one. And
you were the only one.
And everyone thought I was a State Department employee until
cool.
I eventually
it's
fessed up.
It's the suit, man, right?
It was a suit.
And what happened when you fessed up? They were like, oh, he's just a Jefferson Fellow. Or were they like, ooh.
Oh, no, it helped. Plus, some of the other federal people in these working groups are people with PhDs that eventually went to work for the government in a policy role.
Oh, okay.
So there were other PhD types there. Most of them weren't active researching scientists, mm-hmm. but they understood how labs worked and the issues.
Cool.
Before
we get back to you walking around in a suit and fessing up to the fact that you're a Jefferson Fellow, if you've got a question or comment about science and policy and the Yellow Brick Road that Rob went down as a Jefferson Fellow.
Or a policy that you'd like for Rob to make.
Instituted in science.
Yeah.
Give us a call here if you're listening live Wednesdays Eastern Time from noon to 1 Eastern Time. 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. Okay, so you're visiting labs. Now, what you're doing sounds very systematic.
Now that might sound biased, because who do we pick? The part that I saw that had the greatest effect was during the course of the 6 months, we had two or three public open forums. These were day-long meetings that were publicized to the right scientific communities. Mm-hmm. Like in the case of the one on select agents, we publicized it through the American Society for Microbiology or whatever they're called.
Okay. And that's pretty
broad. We put
broad.
Notice to the Federal Register. We went to the Association of Biosafety Officers that every campus has.
Yeah, very broad.
And I would say those public meetings were structured in a way where there's a panel and then people could ask questions and complain. And I saw firsthand, after each of these public meetings, we would have a debriefing session for like 2 hours or we would discuss all the comments people made.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw how that public input made light bulbs go off in a lot of these career federal people's heads of, oh, that's why this is a bad idea. Those public meetings had a lot of impact,
so
but how they're publicized
is working. Government
it's
is
working,
actually
working to a point.
Okay, well, look, I'll take
after
it
the
to
break.
A point.
I'll talk about what happened to all that information.
Wow, so it doesn't go down a giant abyss of a hole.
Sometimes right. It does.
Sometimes it does. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. Sometimes it does. All right, Trent's getting ready to leave. Apparently, he's getting ready to flee the premises. But we'll take a quick break. But again, if you've got a question or comment about science and science policy and how things work for scientists like Rob in Washington, give us a call here if you're listening live Wednesdays, noon to 1 Eastern time at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back on Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
It's not hard to find the best reggae that Atlanta has to offer. Know your roots. Keep it simple. Tune in to 5446, Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta.
Can't stand pop music? Tired of the same old rock and roll? Looking for something fresh? Listen to the original music, African music, on the Sub-Saharan Vibes Show. We're on every Monday from 9 to 10 p.m. on WREK Atlanta at 91.1 on your radio dial. It might just change your whole perspective on music.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Rob Butera, former Jefferson Fellow and occasionally an advisor to the government who was allowed to eat in the fancy GS-15 dining room.
Right.
But if you are listening and you do have a question or comment about science and how that works in Washington, give us a call at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number in the studio, 404-894-2468. And just before the break, he was talking about how the government actually learned from open forum public meetings, and they garnered a plethora, no less, of information. Mm-hmm. And he was just about to tell us what they did with that information.
Okay, so eventually, as I mentioned, we'd have these wrap-up meetings after the public forum where we, the federal people, are on the committee, and I was a pretend Fed, but I was essentially a deputized one, would discuss all the comments people made, and that was one of my times in D.C. I really saw light bulbs go off in people's heads where their perception was changed and they realized, wow, I heard this issue over and over. What can we do to fix this? So after these public hearings and lots of people giving, background informational talks, I actually got to give one myself, which was kind of interesting. It wasn't a very boring topic, but...
What was the topic? I'd love to hear this.
I gave a one-hour talk surveying the how all the countries of the world, which aren't many, that have laws regulating work on biological substances and what that framework is. You know, what substances they control, do they control or regulate lab access, do they require background checks on people, and trying to compare our processes in the U.S. with the 10 or so other countries that had very different processes.
Well, that's not that boring. Interesting. That's important, but what bothers me
is... And it was very hard to compile.
There's only 10 of them. That's what bothers me.
Maybe 15.
Okay, there's only 15 of them. That's what bothers me.
And just because a country has a law in the books doesn't mean that's what actually happens.
I mean, kind of like Wall Street. Sorry, I had to go.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so what were these talks called? The ones you admitted?
They were just called public open forums.
Okay. So
if somebody was in Washington on a vacation, is there some public forum that they could attend one of these to see what goes on?
No, that's the thing. The only place you could find these is something almost nobody reads, which is the Federal Register.
Okay.
There's always an announcement in the Federal Register, but that's read about as much as, you know, like we all live in DeKalb County.
The Bible. Yeah.
I live in Cobb County, where we don't believe in evolution.
So, like in DeKalb County, if they're gonna actually like foreclose on a house, they have to publish it in a newspaper that nobody reads. Mm-hmm. The Federal Register is kind of like that.
Yeah. So, but let me ask you.
But they do try to contact all the relevant professional societies and organizations that they think have a stake in publicizing
these announcements. So you could potentially go.
You could.
General public could go hear this on, like, if you wanted to take your kids and say, this is how they make sausage, don't ever do this.
If you happen to be reading the Federal Register when it was announced 4 months before the meeting, you could go to that.
But let me ask you a quick question, because when I was a kid, I remember looking at the Federal Register, and it was paper. Mm-hmm. Can you skim it electronically now?
Yes. There are even companies you can pay to do it for you.
Okay, to look for your relevant
federal topics. Contractors do this to find things to bid on.
But, I mean, if I went to the government and looked for Federal Register, could I find this? And
yes, maybe, you could.
Okay, all right, so it's electronic. There you go, Federal Register. Mm-hmm. When it was paper, it was utterly unusable. And that was, you know, a few decades ago, so.
Mm-hmm. And it came out every day.
Yeah?
Still comes out every day.
Okay. But I'm not going to see these on, like, C-SPAN. I watch C-SPAN a lot.
In fact,
I don't see
some texts that I wrote wound up accidentally being used in the Federal Register, actually intentionally.
Did you intentionally? Not accidentally.
Did you put that on your resume?
No, I can't. This is probably I know we're going off on another tangent, but it's how one way government.
We live on a tangent.
Well, actually, this tangent gets to my next point. So, what do we do with all that information?
Well, then it's not really a tangent, though, is it?
Yeah, it would be a bisecting.
It's a secant.
We have to write a report. And so we all divvy up into subcommittees. We write our respective sections. But then who decides what's the official word? Can't see me do the quotes on the radio.
He's
of the
doing
U.S.
Our
government.
Quotes, ladies and gentlemen.
And so this is where the bureaucracy becomes painful, and a lot of policy gets made this way. You've written your report. Well, you can't just release it. You have to go through what's called clearing it. And so I would have to take this draft, and I would have to circulate it within the State Department to any office, as dictated by my office director, that we thought had a stake in this issue. And they all have to approve on the content of that report. Mm-hmm. And every other federal agency has to do the same thing. This can be very tedious and painful. We spend a lot of time clearing documents where you say, I must have clearance by Friday. And you actually have to document who are the 12 people that actually read it and signed off on it. And so this is where the authorship thing gets very opposite of academia. In academia, we want credit for our contributions. We don't plagiarize. We acknowledge where everything comes from. And the government, it's the opposite. The easiest way to get a document cleared is to reuse text that's already appeared in a government document.
Kind of like FDA approval, almost.
If you use a material
that's already been approved, your device is
okay. And with official government documents, your name goes nowhere, though in certain little circles, everyone kind of knows who wrote what. But the more you can reuse text that's out there, the easier something is to clear.
So that was an eye-opener. They do whatever the policy does, whatever it can to squelch innovation and unique ideas.
Right. Because sometimes in the process of clearing, you have to re-educate your colleagues in your own department about all the stuff your committee has spent the last 6 months working on.
Yeah. So now I'm not feeling so good. I'm slightly nauseous. I think I'm going to hurl. I'm not really sure.
But then when that's all done,
don't do that.
You write a report. In fact, this report was so high profile, it's posted on the White House's website. But many of these are little committee reports that are like 5 or 6 pages. Still.
And this is the one on biological weapons.
And you can't put that on your resume?
Actually, I'm in a I'm actually acknowledged in a footnote for a presentation I gave.
So, I mean, you know, like...
But he did put eight in the GS-15 diagram.
I was one of 100 people that contributed to that thing.
So, Carl, but you could get a Nobel Prize for that, you know.
His name's Rob. Who are you talking to?
So, I mean, Carl Sagan, I was going to mention.
Oh, sorry.
I read a biography of him, and at the time of his death, his resume or vita was 350 pages long because it had everything in it. So if he gave a talk to the Seneca Falls Kiwanis Club, that ended up as a line on his vita. So you could certainly find a place for it, right?
Under he's going to put this show appearance on it prominently, right at the top.
That's the way he rolls. That's the way he rolls, yeah. No, I think he wants to not let anybody know he did.
All right, so this report was on the White House website? So what did you conclude? What was it? It's out there, right? What did this report conclude?
Actually, I sent you the article.
Oh, via email?
So our report, we clear it internally. Our committee's done with it. Now is where the train sometimes goes off the tracks. We have recommendations. Now it has to trickle up and get approved by all the political appointees. And so, you know, the civil servants, they're there no matter who the administration is, and they do their job. And they try to stay away from politics and to stick to the facts and distill stuff.
Okay.
But then eventually the political appointees have to approve stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, you know, sometimes horse trading and compromises and worse things can go on.
So we're talking about horse trading and compromises on what you might potentially call a fact.
Or even what should be done about the fact.
Okay. Well, that's policy. I understand why you can debate
that. Our issue was so non-political, not many people disagreed about the facts. They just disagreed about the level to which changes were necessary.
Okay. So they agreed biological weapons and the research thereof should be monitored closely.
Biological weapons, bad.
So
right, that's it.
So anyway, our report triggered a whole bunch of new committees to get created. Mm-hmm. In fact, some money was given to the National Academies of Science to create a couple committees to look at particular issues where the National Academy is probably the best organization that were created. I mean, you and I as scientists, we think of that as some big thing that poobah people get elected to.
Mm-hmm.
The National Academy serve a much more important role. Is any federal agency or Congress can give the National Academy money and say, we need some advice on this issue. Mm-hmm. And they will convene a committee of experts. And in my experience, because I've been to maybe half a dozen of these committees type meetings, they do a really good job picking the experts.
Yeah, I think they do.
And so the result of our report, I sent you an article in Science from July 2010 of some mm-hmm. stuff that was triggered by the creation of this report. They convened some committee of experts on some very specific topics of, you know, based on this report, what could be done in the future scientifically and how would that translate to policy changes?
Right. In fact, I've referenced numbers of these reports in grant proposals. There was one about mm-hmm. how to engage people into getting into science and engineering,
and
changing the conversation. They're
stuff,
quite good.
Yeah.
They always write a report.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all those reports are commissioned by either Congress or a federal agency.
They're quite good. I've read a number of them.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
At any point, do you get the don't go getting no smart ideas kind of response from
anybody? That obstacle?
Yes. Even with now, so State Department is a mega bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's people that are very politically skilled in navigating that bureaucracy. So it's a very rigid hierarchy. When you're junior, it's made clear that you're junior and you must defer to people who are more senior than you. And it's completely run by people who majored in history and political science and lawyers and things like that.
What's that like?
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Oh, no. I worked with a lot of policy people who are really good. But the point is, it's not a typical career path for being a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And even the places that make science policy, well, they have a lot of PhDs. I'd say they don't always get the respect they deserve. Like, you're one of those PhD wonky types.
Mm.
Well, he is.
Was he pointing to me? I was looking down at my notes.
He was pointing directly at me.
What is a wonk? I see that all the time.
It's an acronym for something.
Yeah, is a wonk a compliment or is it an insult?
We can't define it.
It's context dependent.
Yeah, we can't. It's an acronym. I can't. Off air, I'll tell you.
Okay.
I didn't think it was an acronym. I thought a wonk was one of these.
It's not, but I'm making one up.
Geeky. He's making one up. He's actually doing that, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's got at least two swear words in it. But I mean, a wonk is basically one of these political, one of these don't be getting no mm-hmm. smart ideas mm-hmm. fella kind of dudes. Mm-hmm. I don't really know. So, okay, now where were we? I don't even know where we were.
NAS.
Oh yeah, so you were asking him the question. Did you have a deliverance moment where someone asked you to squeal like a pig for something?
No, actually,
you sure got a pretty mouth or something like that.
My situation was weird because I was not a civil servant. So when I was hired into my office, placed. I think one of the confusions was no one knew where I was in that level of seniority and experience. I kind of circumvented that whole thing and just reported to my office director.
And also, you were young for a Jefferson Fellow, right?
I was, so I was 41, and there are a couple of us in our 40s, but most of them were 50s more,
and
more
60s.
Senior.
Right.
I have some gray hair, but most of these people had more gray hair than me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There are people in their late 50s, early 60s.
Right.
So
right.
You could just bluff your way through. Just walk in like Lyndon Johnson. Hey, what you doing
but,
here?
But I will say that the fact that I was a real practicing scientist as opposed to a guy with a got their PhD 15 years ago and have been in government ever since actually got me a certain amount of
cachet.
People would listen to what I had to say because of that more than, oh, you're just a PhD who left academia 20 years ago and now you're just like every other government bureaucrat. And and I have to say, the role of PhDs in government is huge. And I wish we had more of them. And in fact, the AAAS fellowship program is the number one way that PhDs get jobs working for government.
I was actually looking into that program. It looks really neat.
Having said that, most of the PhDs I met in government do suffer from the fact that once they're in government, they stay there. They're not actively using that. They're
brain.
Not active in the lab anymore.
Right, right.
And that's good and bad. They're very often they're very dedicated. They're very aware on the policy side. They know their issues. But in the context I was working in, which was, you know, ultimately resulted in regulations that affect scientists, they needed people connected to the lab. And I'm not even a microbiologist. I wasn't affected by most of these regulations, except that I use some of the toxins they talked about in our lab in small quantities for some of the research we do.
Just a disciplined graduate student. No, I'm just
kidding. It's worth mentioning there was another board where they got this feedback. So NIH actually had this board called the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity. And this board meets three times a year. It's a federal advisory panel. People have standing four-year memberships. And it's all leading scientists in this field of people who work on really dangerous bugs and can give the government very candid feedback on how all these regulations are working. And they advise them on everything from where the threats are to how are the regulations helping or stifling research.
Okay.
And I was very impressed at the feedback that those committees gave. I went to most of their meetings when I was there.
All right, so before we try to wrap up and figure out what we've learned today, I mean, what was your overall summary of the experience? Was this a good thing? Do you think this program is helping government departments learn the important stuff about science?
If I think about my experience and the experience of my other fellows, it's definitely helping. I just gave you my viewpoint, which was very Washington-focused. I could talk about some of the work of some of the other fellows. So two of the fellows kind of worked together. They both devoted part of their time to a project about developing better cook stoves for developing countries, which is getting a lot of press lately. You might think, a stove to cook on, what's the big deal? But apparently,
what is the big deal?
You go to developing countries where people cook inside tents, and depending what they're burning, you create a lot of black carbon and soot emissions. It's got atmospheric effects. It has major health effects. And so actually developing a simple stove that burns efficiently and cleanly can be produced at a very small price and be given away is a big deal. There are entire nonprofit organizations dedicated to developing these stoves, which become interesting research projects.
Couldn't we just give them microwave ovens?
No electrical grid.
No grid.
These people
are
burning buffalo poo in their stoves sometimes, dude. Okay.
So the challenge has actually been, I think, for myself and a lot of the other fellows, is the second half of this fellowship is we're supposed to be available to the State Department for expertise for 5 years.
Oh, okay.
The trouble is the bureaucracy of the State Department doesn't have a good mechanism in place to actually have us provide that expertise.
Okay, so basically they call you with 3 hours' notice and say, get on a plane, you got to be here.
You know, I'll give you an example. My office director, and I don't know who would ever run a company this way or an academic lab, doesn't actually have a budget for the office. He gets slots for people.
Okay.
But if he wanted me to go there for a couple months, he would actually have to go beg for the money to do so. It's not like he could just make room in his budget and make
it happen. Or he'd have to lay somebody off for a couple of months.
And so generally, the way this organization works, procuring money for things that are outside typical annual appropriations is hard.
Okay. Okay. All right, so that's too bad. All right, so let's see if we can recap what we've learned, ladies and gentlemen, in talking to Rob Butera. I think the first thing we learned is that back when he was 6 years old, Rob actually carried ding-dongs in his lunch pail,
yeah.
Much like Bill claims Elvis did.
Yeah.
And he spent this time as a Jefferson Fellow, and you were working what, on sort of arms, chemical and biological arms proliferation issues?
Non-proliferation issues.
Okay, I'm not trying to say. Yeah, let's give away the stoves and, sarin gas.
Anthrax, yeah.
And I guess it's markedly different approaches for the Congress versus the federal department side. And, in Congress, people have a focus on getting reelected, particularly those in the House of Representatives.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah, and it's very difficult to change their minds at that point. The nice thing is there might be a mechanism through their staffers, that if you can get a hold of a staffer who thinks it's a relevant issue for their particular Congress.
And sort of doing what we do on Inside the Black Box and educating the public is the way to go.
Right. And what I heard from Rob is that the public forums, these open meetings where you have people that come either because they look at the online Federal Register, which I'm going to start looking at now, or through the professional society, and we do get these things, right, through the American Chemical Society and things like that. There is actually information that's important that's being relayed to the federal government, and there are, let me see if I can quote Rob, light bulbs going on in this process.
Right.
So that's very, very encouraging. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you take that information, and through these interagency policy committees, it gets going back and forth, and eventually staffers who, in dealing with these staffers, it's like herding cats, might get some of this to the Congress people, but you eventually go through your department, get this all put together, and let's face it, there's a little politics involved with that, but basically these are non-political appointees trying to put together what they think is the best set of facts and recommendations, right?
Right.
So that's a good thing. Then it goes up the ladder. And can we say God only knows what happens to it when the political appointees get to it and things like that? Or if you said that, they'd have to kill you.
No, political appointees come in all shapes and sizes. Many of them are quite qualified.
Okay. All right. So in general, the message is very heartening that information about science does get imparted to people in Washington. It does get put into policy because there are, as you said before, lots of PhDs in science. And basically, the one recommendation I'm getting out of this is that programs like the Jefferson Fellows Program and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS Fellows, who, by the way, give you your training. I called it DC for Dummies. What did you call it?
DC for scientists.
DC for scientists, okay. So DC for scientists, that's probably what they think of us as. DC for scientists is a good idea, and you actually get a lot of people in there contributing to science. But you know what it sounds like? It sounds like rather than having the AAAS fellows going there and remaining in government for the rest of their lives, we ought to have more rotating positions like the Jefferson fellows.
Well, the AAAS fellows don't, many of them do rotate back out.
Oh,
the young ones who tend to be recent PhDs and postdocs often use that, and many agencies hire from them. But
right.
I've met AAAS fellows as old as 65 years old who are professors who did it on a sabbatical.
Okay, because I was actually looking into this. And being a smart aleck, would that really keep me from getting that job?
Oh, that would help tremendously.
Depends where you got placed.
Keep doing that. Keep doing that. Speak your mind.
What would be the place that a smart aleck would want to go? Would it be the State Department? Would it be
firing squad?
It would depend on the local office environment.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But I mean, that's
just
something
like any
that
job.
The National Science Foundation does. So it's good to hear that we have some rotating folks here. So we got a glimpse into how science happens.
Right.
And the story isn't so bad. What did we leave out? Any other comments?
No, I think wanna? Really good.
Rob, any other comment on that?
That's it.
All right. Well, Rob, thank you so much for being on the program. And we may have to continue this.
I never talked about much of the foreign component of what I did.
And we better get into some of the real dirt, the really nitty-gritty stories. You can change the names to protect the innocent if you want.
Yeah.
But hopefully we do that on another
special
show.
Special trip he took to Libya.
Yeah, absolutely. But if you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show on Inside the Black Box, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman. Our theme music is written and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.